And welcome back to the Famous Monsters Podcast, your home to all things horror, sci-fi, fantasy, and all those paper cuts you got from reading books. Books, because paper doesn't need to be charged. I am your host, Jordan, the jack of all trades. And with me is Jason, the...
Caca! That one was actually a bird noise this week. Last time it was a cat for some reason.
Yeah, last time it was a meow. Yeah.
And of course, we got with us Holly Interlandi.
Yo, how's it going?
What up? So, on the matter of books, someone on Twitter recently, Alex Vorkov, had put up a very interesting question that we liked, which was, do you prefer the novel over the film, or do you like it when the director or creator goes with their own vision and kind of takes their own twist? And surprisingly enough, 51% actually liked it when the filmmaker went with their own vision. Now, with us, this is a debate that we probably had, not something we probably knew we were talking about, but it definitely pops up, I feel, within conversation.
Uh-huh.
And
yes, definitely.
We've never actually stuck our flag in the ground and decided where each of us lies on this matter. So today we're going to find out where we all stand on this debate. I know I've been thinking about it for a while. I'm pretty sure you all have also, and have devised our list of books to films and everything. And it's tough. It is really hard because there are some films that are just phenomenal, you know, especially when you got someone like Stephen King, where almost everything he makes gets turned into a live action something or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. You know?
And some are amazing, some not so much. And some surpass the book so much that people forget there's a book.
Yeah, that's true.
Which is sad because books are superior, but we're not going to get into that.
But we kind
Holly
of
has planted her flag. We kind of are getting into that. I have lots of opinions about books.
Well, with that, being the person who in the group is a writer, is an editor, someone who I consider our personal library. I used to be called the librarian for comic books, but I consider you a librarian when it comes to all literature.
Mm-hmm. Aww,
where do you stand on this?
When it comes to full-length novels, I am absolutely in favor of the director changing the ending, changing, you know, whatever they need to change to make it a coherent film. Because I feel like the two mediums are so different that it's almost impossible to translate a novel exactly into a film that feels like a movie, you know? The exception is, for me anyway, is when the movie is based on a short story, because short stories and movies tend to have similar, not similar lengths, but similar narrative scope. And so a short story will often make a better movie than a novel will, in my opinion.
Mm. Yeah.
Kind of because they have the same beats and they're going for the same objective in a way.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. You were talking about Stephen King. I mean, I'll use him as an example. I don't like Stanley Kubrick's Shining movie. I know a lot of people do, but I don't, because it cuts so much out of the novel. And then there's, what's another example? I mean, recently, you know, it's an 1,100-page book. Mm-hmm. they tried to make it into a pair of movies, and it didn't really work. I knew it wasn't going to work as soon as they said they were going to divide it into the young kids portion and the adult portion, because part of what makes the novel so good is his weaving those two together. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to tell if they're adults or children.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in contrast, the Stephen King adaptations that have worked are the shorter ones, like, for example, The Mist, which is a short story, and the adaptation in film is amazing. It's one of the best adaptations I think there is. There are a couple of other examples. Stand By Me, being adapted from The Body, short story, is the perfect length for a film. You know, it's you don't need a 600-page book to tell a story in film. There are some other examples, too.
Was The Green Mile a short story? That's one of his, right?
Yes, the Green Mile was a series of novellas, which was later collected into a large one. That was a long movie, wasn't it? God, I don't remember it. I only saw it once. So, but in my opinion, it's just that, especially when a novel is really long, it just goes places and goes to a depth that a film generally can,
yeah,
in my opinion.
Yeah, because like I'm glad you brought up, because the two that I immediately thought of were like It and The Mist, because those two things to me are perfect contrasting examples of when sticking closely to the original written material goes wrong and when coming up with a new element goes really right. So the right one obviously would be The Mist, because the ending of The Mist is extremely different from the ending in the book. And that's oh my God, I'm blanking on the director's name. Frank
Darabont.
Okay. I thought that was it,
Frank Darabont. He also
doubted myself. So
yeah, well he's the one. He also did Shawshank Redemption, yeah, which is also his
debut. I mean, he's a phenomenal filmmaker, and the running joke is that Stephen King has issues with his endings, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think changing the ending of The Mist really served the movie super well, because the ending that Stephen King wrote was supposed to be a little bit more hopeful, whereas the one in the movie was just really bleak. I mean, yeah, to go through with what he had to go through and then immediately the military shows up, I mean, that's heart-wrenching.
Yeah.
I love it. I think it's devastating.
Completely. And I mean, I think Stephen King himself said that was excellent, right?
Yeah.
But then I think, like you were talking about with It, there's a lot of things they did with both the 90s adaptation and also the new one that just did not work in their favor.
Yeah.
I can't really think of a good way to split up the movies so that you kind of get the full story of the kids and the adults and have it also be coherent in itself, where you don't necessarily have to see both movies like back to back in order to get it.
Yeah.
But I just don't think sticking to everything that was in the book did any kind of service for the most recent movies. I mean, I mentioned this before when we were talking about It, but having that first scene in the second movie with the homophobic attack, I know that was in the book, but I mean, it ruined the whole movie for me, and the movie was bad on its own without that scene. So it felt really out of place.
I also understand you're not liking that, because people's defense of the opening scene was always, well, it was in the book. Mm-hmm. It was in the book. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, I mean, that works to a certain extent, but I'm with you in that I think it's much better when the director sort of is inspired by the source material and then sort of, I don't know, goes in a different direction, but alters it sufficiently so that it works in a different medium.
Because I mean, the other thing that they did with It was they did change some of it from the book, but then they didn't change other stuff to match the new context. Like, they changed the entire time period, I'm assuming, to have like the flashback scenes and the scenes with the kids hit that sort of 80s nostalgia that's been really big since Stranger Things became really big. And then pick out other parts that obviously you would never be able to show, like the whole, you know, quote unquote sex scene. But then to keep that first scene with the homophobia in it while ignoring the entirely new context that they gave it just seemed like it feels like they didn't think it through. It felt like it was in there for shock value instead of being what Stephen King intended that scene to be in the book. It didn't have any of that context anymore. So it just felt really stale and flat and like mean for the sake of being mean.
Yeah, I feel like we kind of talk about there being agendas with things as of late with a lot of these films. And that's what it felt like with that movie specifically, where it's like they forgot the message or didn't realize what the message was in the story originally.
Mm-hmm.
And they just hooked on that little thing that can grow into like the rest of what they wanted to spread through the rest of the film.
Right.
Because like within the book, I don't remember Richie being homosexual, or if they even hinted towards it in the book. I agree, wrong.
There's a bit of subtext between Richie mm-hmm. and Eddie. Okay. It's not like explicit, but there's subtext that they had a particularly special relationship.
So I guess for me, it never stuck out. Well, in this, like, it felt like there was a spotlight on it mm-hmm. that was never there before. And I felt like, well, we're going to have this scene, and then we're going to show this, and we're going to really put an effort to show all these notes, mm-hmm. while it may not have been prolific before in the novel, just because we want to have this be the thing.
Right.
And in turn, like, for me, it lost any power it could have and should have had.
It seemed like they just really shot themselves in the foot with a bunch of choices that they made for the new movies, which is, it's weird because there's this dichotomy between the two, right? Because the first one was legitimately really good. And then the second one,
the second one.
It totally fell apart. I mean, it chapter one is definitely on my list of top horror movies for the past decade. And chapter two is definitely on my list of the worst. So it's like, it seems they deviated enough from the book for the first one. And it seems like they kind of crafted the whole story around the first movie. And then the second one was just sort of scraps that they were like kind of pulling from the book and then kind of not. I feel like they were kind of marketing it as, oh, it sticks closer to the book than the 90s series, which is kind of is very in and out on that and changed kind of a lot. So it seems like they kind of went towards that, but also wanted to put their own ideas into it. And it just was not clear enough the way that clearly Frank Darabont's ideas for The Mist, he had a very clear idea and executed on it really hard. And it worked really, really well.
Yeah.
And it completely fell through on the other one, on it.
I mean, to bring up, you know, to move beyond mm-hmm. Stephen King, I think two other adaptations where the ending was radically mm-hmm. changed for the better are one, Jurassic Park. Jurassic Park. Where I don't know if you guys have read the book. I read the book like multiple times.
I read the second book, but I never read the first for some reason.
I would sit down and read the whole thing in like one day. but I loved the book, but there's a lot more emphasis on behavioral mm-hmm. science in the book. And so the end was just totally different. Like in the book, Alan Grant is able to escape the velociraptors because he threatens their eggs, mm-hmm. essentially. And it's much slower ending, and it takes its time, and there's none of the T-Rex eats the velociraptor stuff. And that mm-hmm. the book works. But then in the film, I'm actually glad they went with the shocker, you know, big mm-hmm. explosive ending, because that's the kind of ending you need for a film like this. And I think if they had stuck too closely to the book, it would have felt anticlimactic. And weird.
I feel they maybe kind of referenced that ending in Jurassic Park 3, which is a terrible movie, but there is a part where he doesn't threaten the eggs, but someone else steals some of the eggs, and then they shake off the velociraptors by giving the eggs back. So maybe that was meant to tie in.
Yeah. Another thing they did with Jurassic Park 3 was that they put in the scene with the apiary mm-hmm. and the pterodactyls, which was in the first book, but wasn't in the first movie.
So that's interesting. That it seems like they kind of referenced that between the two movies.
It was almost like, oh, we couldn't do this in the first mm-hmm. movie, so let's go back and do it. But it was still a bad movie.
Totally, it was.
I feel like in some ways, like, the question is then, does time play an issue when it comes to telling these stories in live action? And also, the obvious thing would be the visuals. Mm-hmm. Because you mentioned things like Jurassic Park. We talk about it and everything. One of the things that I have on my list, caught me from like the hardcore comic book realm of the things, mm-hmm. is The Watchmen. Mm-hmm. Now, The Watchmen has been translated in a film and now a TV show. Mm-hmm. Both take different approaches. I guess for me, people will argue this in the comic book world, but I think the Watchmen film is one of the top comic book movie adaptations ever. It's definitely one of the top three.
The Watchmen film is brilliant. I love the Watchmen film. Yeah, so
the
much.
Argument is that Zack Snyder went too exact on how he did this movie, where he's just taking things straight from the panels, straight from the dialogue. Mm-hmm. And I say it's like, well, a comic book really is just storyboarding. Storyboarding is what they do to make films. They plan everything out in little blocks with action movements and words. It's like, how is it any different? Mm-hmm. If the book is already a classic and a masterpiece, why would you mess with that?
But then at the same time, he did change the ending to something I thought was for the better with the Dr. Manhattan energy signal and forcing him to go off world. Whereas in the book, it's the giant alien.
Well, here's the thing. I'm going to go with that. With this TV show, I don't know if you guys have watched it yet.
I haven't.
But they actually stick to the book. And they stick, and they have the giant squid thing be in there.
Mm.
And so the TV story, it goes into the future. It's like present day time, we'll say. And Ozymandias is still in Antarctica. And every once in a while, he'll drop squids, like baby squids, onto like locations in the world to make them like believe that the threat is still out there. So be good. Honestly, in the show,
that's actually kind of hilarious.
It really works. And for me, it shows it's like, man, it could have been possible in the movie. It could have been, because when you read it in the book, it didn't feel weird. It didn't feel out of place because you're reading a comic book and it's this supernatural world at this point. Mm-hmm. And so if you can see something like Dr. Manhattan pop up in the movie, then anything is possible. Anything goes, pretty much.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember being in the theater watching it, and like I love that book so much. I read that book probably over and over again in a week. I remember I actually bought the trade and had it into my bathroom as like reading material.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up sitting in the bathroom reading the whole book in one sitting. And Jen's like, are you okay in there? I was like, yeah, I've been done for a while. I just had to read.
It's a very digestible book, to be fair.
And here's the other thing. And we talk about like following the vision. While that movie followed the book practically to a T, besides the ending following its own beat, he didn't add that little side story that the kid was reading of that comic book. He didn't add the Hollis Mason little story and everything of what it was to be a hero. Like, he didn't add all those little things. While at the same time, the TV show kind of delves into those little nuances a little bit more. Hmm. And both work, honestly. But I love that movie. I think it shows that you can be exact with the material. And as a fan, like, I couldn't get enough of it. Stuff like that. Sin City is another great example.
Mm-hmm.
Part one, at least.
Yep.
Part two is whatever.
Yeah.
But that first one, and just visually matching what you saw in the book. And granted, comic books give you a different dynamic because you actually do get pictures to follow, as opposed to just following someone's description and trying to match it. You know, maybe like Lord of the Rings style.
Right.
Yeah. Well, but Lord of the Rings is another example of the fact that Peter Jackson was able to adapt those books in the first place is a miracle. And I think the only reason it worked was because he deviated so far from the book.
Yeah.
It would not have worked if an example? If there are more stuff about like the Ents, for example, like their scene was perfect by itself. And I think it's a miracle that he was able to adapt it. And I think it worked because he wasn't a slave to what was
actually. He worked with time. Like they gave him the time he needed, like to be able to do a 3-hour plus film.
Right.
That helps.
Exactly. Yeah. That did help a lot.
I'm glad that you brought up Lord of the Rings, because that was actually exactly what I was going to bring up next. That's another example of where the ending is drastically different, because, you know, the ending in the movies is when they finally achieve the goal that they've been working to the whole time, which is destroying the ring. But then in the book, there's this whole bit with Saruman taking over the Shire. So they get home and then they have to fight Saruman. And I feel like it would have kind of posed the same problem that you mentioned with Jurassic Park, where it's like, that's not a very climactic ending to
what essentially is like 10 hours of film at that point. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I think that Lord of the Rings and Sin City are both examples of where sticking to the aesthetic really, really, really works. And I guess, like, yeah. I don't really want to talk about the Harry Potter films, but they match the aesthetic of the books pretty well. So I feel like the aesthetic for a lot of things is almost more important to match than the actual, I guess, sort of specific plot details. Because I think that, yeah.
That's a really good point.
I just rewatched the Fellowship of the Ring a couple nights ago. And it's amazing how well those hold up. And I think it's because of the visual aesthetic that Peter Jackson dedicated so much energy towards.
Yeah. Well, I mean, now that you've mentioned aesthetic, that makes sense that the other book I was going to bring up, which is Anne Rice's Interview with the Vampire. The film matches the aesthetic like to a T. Everything from like the decadence to the drama to the Louis angsting to like the not so subtext, right. homosexual subtext. To all of it, it matches it perfectly, and then it changes the ending because it needed to, because the ending in the book is you're sort of like it's quieter and it doesn't really have a conclusion, but then in the film to bring Lestat back, and have him bite Daniel, because in the book series it's actually Armand who comes and turns Daniel into a vampire, but that's a whole other thing. But in this film, the way they did it, it was the perfect explosive ending that you needed. After watching a 2.5-hour movie about, the doldrums of being a vampire, they put this ending in there that's like, whoa, okay, cool. And then, you've got the Guns N' Roses covering Sympathy of the Devil, and like just the ending of that film is absolutely perfect. So I think it's incredible that they were able to stick to the aesthetic of the book and mostly the plot as well. And then totally change the ending and have it just work.
Yeah.
Like, so
I think it's really important when studios and producers allow like the directors and the people making the movie to take like sort of the, like you said, the time and like sort of, I guess, the risk to make the aesthetics match. Like, you don't see movies like Sin City at all anymore. And I think it worked for 300 too.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good point. Maybe we should call it the Frank Miller aesthetic.
Yeah, honestly. Yeah. But I mean, you and really that's where need
it goes back to Zack Snyder too. Zack Snyder, like, he can make a good looking film.
It's true. I mean, when you give it to people that have a strong sense of aesthetic, like Zack Snyder or Robert Rodriguez, I mean, I wish that only people like that would make comic book movies, and then we can kind of be done with the rest of it.
Yeah. I agree. But that's not going to happen because comic book movies are, they sell.
Well, now, I didn't like Joker as a movie, but at least Todd Phillips, is that his name?
Yeah.
Least he had an aesthetic he wanted and went for it. It was, it wasn't the look or the acting in that movie made me not like it. It was just, I guess, the story. I don't know. I have a lot of different gripes with it, but the aesthetic was definitely not it. That was one thing that kept me from, like, hating it, I guess.
Yeah. Well, once you've seen Taxi Driver, you don't have to watch Taxi Driver. Well,
that's true.
That's a good point, but also he basically just took the character and did his own thing. It didn't have an origin in a comic book really at all. So I think that's also part of the reason that it succeeded, was because he was, dedicated to this vision that didn't previously exist. He just sort of lifted the character and the concept and was like, okay, I'm going to tell my own story.
That actually makes me it makes me think of something that you and I have talked about kind of at length before, George, which is animated comic book movies and shows and stuff, I guess.
Oh.
Because comic books obviously are all illustrated. Why not have more animated comic book movies? I mean, look at Into the Spider-Verse.
Yeah.
It's animation.
Exactly. Yeah. Animation. I mean, I think Into the Spider-Verse is the best comic book movie that has ever been made.
Yes.
Because it's animated.
Hands down.
Okay. That's fine. I disagree a little bit, but that's yeah, because that, I have better taste in films than you. So.
But
my all-time comic book adaptation would be The Crow. But anyway, go ahead.
Because I think you get that that ability to match an aesthetic without having to translate it into what does this look like in real life, which sometimes can go really poorly and sometimes can go really well. Yeah. Whereas if you just are not afraid to do something animated, you can make it just match that. I mean, there's still, of course, ways to screw it up.
Well,
I feel like it gives people like a little bit better of a shot at hitting the mark for the people that are fans of the books.
Well, obviously, the Japanese agree because manga become anime before they ever become live action films. So
that is true.
So I have one on my list here that I feel will be the one that probably destroys our fans a little bit.
Oh, I'm very excited for this now.
Because it's a classic movie monster. It's Frankenstein.
Uh-huh.
And I grew up loving that book so much. And I have nothing against the Universal Boris Karloff Frankenstein. I like that movie equally so.
Mm-hmm.
But it's nothing like the book. No. That Frankenstein is not the Frankenstein that I grew up reading. It is not Mary Shelley's creation at all.
Right.
Agreed.
And where it starts to have a branch where like it's you just take the name of something and create your own thing. And it ends up being amazing and a classic.
Yeah.
But I love the book so much and what it does for that character. So like for me, my favorite Frankenstein movie in turn is not that one, but the one with Robert De Niro in it. Because it attempts to recreate what the book did. Like I always enjoyed seeing the creature become a human again.
Right.
And you know, and try to learn what it was to be alive and be in this world, his relationship with his quote unquote father. You know. I enjoyed all that so much. And so to not have that happen in the original, it's like, why couldn't you have just done that story for me? But since I get it, you know, you gotta do what works for the time and what they had and all this stuff.
Right. Like that's a perfect example of why having like live action things, because you're limited by what kind of special effects you have available to you. Right. Because that was the whole thing. Like, that's why Boris Karloff didn't talk in that movie. And he did and looked different in Bride of Frankenstein is in order to achieve that look, he couldn't move his mouth hardly, which is why you just get the moaning sounds.
Yeah.
And so, it just kind of ties more into that whole like live action is always going to be limited by effects, whether it's practical or CG. Whereas like with animation, you don't have those limits.
Well, and look at Lord of the Rings. It took 50 years to adapt because they had to wait till they actually had the technology to do it.
It holds up. And I think having such a strong visual aesthetic for those, I was talking to Thurston about this while we were watching it, is a lot of the effects that are in that would be really, really cheesy to see right now if the rest of the entire setting wasn't so extremely stylized. And I feel like that's what the MCU kind of drops the ball on sometimes, is that they're so dedicated to making everything look as realistic as possible. Then they add in some dodgy CG and it just kind of takes you out of it. Whereas if they pushed it to be even more of like a visual style like Sin City or 300, the weird CG or like weird slow-mo doesn't look out of place because everything is so stylized.
In my opinion, the MCU peaked with Winter Soldier. And then steadily went downhill after that.
here's where I'll tap onto that. I'll tap onto those things right now because I think what they were talking about for visual effects is you mentioned the word real a lot. With Lord of the Rings, a lot of things were real.
Mm-hmm.
Like he managed to still use a lot of practical and CGI and was able to marry them together so well. Like a lot of the scenery we saw was not CG. It was real scenery, but it was all miniature scales.
Right.
Using that some of miniature scales and then putting and using the CGI to meld it together was masterful. And to just take that time, because that, again, time it plays the biggest issue there. It's like the fact that the studios let him do that was phenomenal. While with the MCU, like you mentioned, Winter Soldier, again, a lot of practical effects were used for that movie. A lot of the stunts were real and everything. Like the car chase, all real cars. Like they were jumping out of vehicles. Chris Evans actually had to fall on a door, falling onto the ground, you know, while once we went over to like Civil War and everything else, they were relying on the CG more. The thing that boggles my mind with them is how, for instance, we all watched, I think, the last ones, what were they, Infinity War and Endgame? Yeah. Like Endgame, all those suits, those time travel suits were all CG and they looked like they were real as hell. Like there was no way of telling that those were not real. But at the same time, you have that scene at the end where they're all the big battle and you can totally see how CG like the Hulk is and everything. And it kind of sucks to have something look so good in one scene and ends up slightly fall apart in another.
That's how I felt about.
I think it's because there's just so
much. Yeah,
that's how I felt about Black Panther too. Was like so much in that movie. Was so stylized and looked so crisp and so good. And then I think it was like mostly kind of towards the end, there were like bits where the CG was just like a little bit off. I wish that editors were more inclined to kind of take risks and make, like, if you're going to make the whole thing, no part of it is realistic. It's a superhero story from a comic book. So why not just go all in?
Yeah.
I mean, I think Sin City is maybe one of the most extreme examples because, like, again, nothing looks like that except for the other Sin City, like, spinoffs and sequels or whatever. Like, The Spirit, I never saw it, but it had that, like, same look.
Yeah.
Oh, but yeah, The Spirit totally did.
I mean... I don't really care that much for the story of Sin City, but I love it because of the aesthetic.
Something I was going to fork off into after like the Frankenstein thing was how it seems like depending on what it is, the new approach takes on a life of its own and that becomes the basic norm. So for instance, like if you're going to make a Frankenstein film today with all the monsters, you're going to make the Boris Karloff style Frankenstein. That's what everyone makes. And I feel like that's something that's also happened to another big thing, which is the 007 James Bond. Like Ian Fleming's James Bond is not what we have in the films, especially not today, you know. And it's gotten to that point where like now he's his, the 007 that we know is that's what it is. It's not the the character it was from the books, because the books are definitely they're not as fast paced at all, as you know, especially once we got into like the 80s and the 90s with Pierce Brosnan and everything. Like, that was just all how techie can we get and how much is it almost MCU like, how much CG can we drop into this thing? And that's the James Bond we know today. We know an action-packed James Bond. We don't know the espionage style where he's actually having to do things in the shadows kind of thing. Like in the books, we get to see how smooth and how he actually uses his brain. While in what we have now, it's just like, how hard can he punch through a wall?
It's true. <You know? laughs> Yeah, that's a good point.
But that's what people know, and that's what they're used to. So to show them the book, it's like, well, that's boring.
Well,
that brings up, you know, another point, is which is that what was often riveting in a novel is boring on screen, you know? Regardless of what era you're in or what you're adapting. Because a novel uses, you know, a different medium and can often... you know, manipulate the words and the sentences and the lines to make something really, really exciting. If you try to put that on film, it just...
That
just
actually like, reminds me of... I haven't actually watched the anime series, but it seems like we have a tendency in these podcasts to arrive back on Junji Ito a lot of the time. And... he is the best. And one of his things that he uses, which is so specific to a paper medium, is the page turn. Because so many times you're like dreading turning the page because you're like, I know I'm about to see something horrifying. And it puts that dread into you physically. And then you turn the page and it indeed is a huge, horrifying, super detailed picture. And it doesn't translate to the screen that well. Again, I haven't watched the new anime, but I have watched some reviews and breakdowns of it. And there seems to be a general kind of consensus that it's really bad because they literally just translated everything almost kind of panel for panel, but very poorly. So like everyone is still in the same positions, but there's a key element that you can see in the page that is not on the screen, and it makes the whole thing look pretty flat and dull because they're paying attention to the actions and not the intentions or aesthetics of the stories that they're adapting.
Have you seen the live action Uzumaki? It's actually not bad. Obviously, it doesn't cover the scope of the comic book because, you know, movies don't do that. It ends relatively early in the Uzumaki story, but they did a pretty good job.
But that's something that clearly Ito knows so well how to manipulate the medium of paper and reading it and turning, like physically turning the pages, that you just like that impact has to be made up on screen somehow. And that's a hard thing to try to figure out. So in that case, I think it would be much better to, you know, for the director to put their own adaptation on it. Like a good example of someone doing it well, I would say, is probably the JoJo's Bizarre Adventure anime. Because the manga is super weird for its own reasons. And oftentimes, like on the color pages, like covers and pinups and stuff, the author and artist, Hirohiko Araki, is just doing whatever. He's changing colors like crazy. So that in the anime, they chose to have entire color palette switches happen for emphasis. So it's not an exact translation of what's on the page. I mean, they match up shot for shot pretty well enough for like, if it's like a standout page in the manga, you can recognize it when you're watching the anime. I'm also like, for listeners, I'm very biased because this is my favorite manga of all time. But using the colors to impact the way that you're watching it on screen, I think is really brilliant. I mean, David Production is the studio that does it, and they really nailed it, I think, because it definitely captures sort of the intent and essence of what makes it a standout manga, and then modernizes it for the screen really well in a way that I don't think the live action. I love the little live action, but it doesn't have the same effect.
Well, I mean, one of my favorite mangakas is Tsutomu Nihei,
did he do Agent?
Blame and Knights of Cydonia, and he has another series.
Was that someone else? Maybe it was just the same studio
And well, his series right now is called Apposims. I think it's interesting because he had another fantastic series called Biomega that was really, really, really intensely detailed on the page. Like it's probably his most detailed.
Because he always goes really hard with that. World building is just,
But I find it interesting that Biomega is the one that didn't get adapted because that's the one that has so much going on the page. Whereas Knights of Cydonia is a, you know, it's a good manga, but the style is very much simplified from Biomega. So I'm wondering if that has something to do with, you know, what they choose to adapt. Like if it's, they look at the page and go, oh, this doesn't need anything.
Yeah.
I mean, if, you know, if only people actually thought that way, but they don't. So.
So within this, we've discovered that Holly, you actually do prefer the vision of the director.
And Jason, I'm very much on the side of like the director should take creative control to try to match the aesthetic, but not like the individual details of the thing.
Okay.
That makes sense. I like that.
Because like that if approach, we want, like, I know we've already talked about Birds of Prey
plot details.
And George, I know how you feel about a lot of the choices they made in Birds of Prey, whereas like that's not Black Canary. And that's not really Cassandra Cain. But to me,
as a comic book purist, it's not correct.
Right.
But as a moviegoer, it's phenomenal.
For sure. Whereas like for me, I don't mind it if it doesn't match the comic book because there's a lot of shit I don't like in comic books. And I think that because they went on the aesthetic for that movie of like the Harley Quinn aesthetic, knocked it out of the park. So I'm very much on the side of like, please make a creative decision if something needs to change. Because, I mean, books are not infallible. I think plenty of comic writers and also Stephen King has proved that. For as good as he is, he definitely has made some
questionable.
It's impossible to have a perfect track record.
Yeah. What makes him good is that he's constantly writing. So when you have, you can succeed 50 times, failing 10 times is okay.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, the ratio of the what ratio about you, George, of birds you to masterpieces is much higher.
I'll be honest, I didn't have an answer before coming into this conversation. And I'm not sure if I still do now, because I know I definitely lean on the aspect of like being true to the source material in some sense, just because if the only in a sense, if the source material was already deemed a classic, like if it's already deemed a masterpiece, if everything about it was already loved and enjoyed, why would you mess with it, per se? But of course, like there are things that we've discussed where it's like, obviously, I love things like Jurassic Park, Lord of the Rings. We didn't even talk about things like Fight Club and Trainspotting. Like these are movies that are so amazing that you you stop talking about the books at some point because of how great the movie was.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm obviously okay with the person being creative and doing their own thing. I think at some point it has to be where the integrity of the story isn't lost. As long as the person understood what the message and what the true meaning of the story was, and understanding what that artist was trying to put out there, because everything is just art. So if you understand what the artist's motivation was, then I think it's okay for the most part. You know, like we talk about Birds of Prey, for instance, changing a character to be black for the sake of them being black, and especially when it's a black canary, it's like, okay, come on, dude, try harder. Or just don't try that hard at all, I should say. That didn't change anything about the character, making it a different race. So it's like you're just trying to pull off something else, which has nothing to do with the actual story. Those things just get in the way for me. Just tell me what the story is and that's it. Don't try to come with other little things that you have on your mind. There's a time and a place for those things. I think that's where I start to get a little annoyed, is when like there's something else that they want to pull off that was never there. So I guess I'm kind of in the middle, but I know there's a part in my heart where I'm definitely more pleased when they're able to pull off something amazing that was actually already there, you know, because that doesn't happen often either. Like it's, I feel like it's rarer where they actually try to stick to the source material and it's amazing. You know, it's almost like they're afraid to go with it.
Yeah, I agree. I think it does come down to like integrity and intent. Like, you know, going back to one of our first examples, like The Mist, obviously there was a commitment to that. And like, what was the point of the story? To have a really overpowering existential horror? I think that Frank Darabont's version saw that intent in the original story and adapted what he felt he needed to in order to drive that intention home.
Yeah.
And I think it worked better than, you know, the original ending would have.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah, I was happy to see that Twitter poll, more people skewed towards wanting directors to have some creative control and change what they felt like they needed to, because I really expected it to go the other way, like really strongly. And I think it was what, like 45% to 55%. So it wasn't really that far off. But yeah, no, it was definitely an excellent question.
Yeah, so thank you, Alex Workov. But I wonder, where do our fans lie on this? Like, granted, anyone who's on our Twitter probably saw that tweet a while back. But if you didn't and you listen to this podcast, you know, what do you like? What do you prefer? Do we got those wheels turning in your head now, making you wonder? It's like, maybe I gotta rethink some of these movies now.
Sounds like my dog has an opinion. Sorry about the barking.
Bucky, where can they follow us? Mark.
And Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Famous Monsters,
Instagram at Famous Monsters.
Thanks, Bucky.
That. Yep.
Until next time, keep reading and keep watching those films.
Bye.